Hey everybody, welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe. The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses, hosted by myself, Dave Cowan, and my good friend Jeff Backus. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. If you have a question or comment for us, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. Without further ado, grab yourself a cup of coffee and get ready for another episode of the Vet Tech Cafe.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe today. Dave, how are you doing down there?
Just had one of those tropical storms the last few days. It's been very wet here lately, but we're getting back into a nicer weather. It's starting to feel like summer here. How's it going up there?
It's going well. We went straight from still winter to construction season. My hour and 10-minute commute is now generally an hour and a half or hour and 45 minutes, so that's fun.
I saw somebody post on Facebook quite a while ago that said, quick, while everyone is not going to work, fix all the roads now. But apparently they didn't hear that.
No, certainly not in Rhode Island. But but otherwise, we're doing good up here, and we're thinking about starting to let people back into the Vet Tech Cafe with some spread seating.
Yeah,
but we'll have to kind of keep an eye on that. But otherwise, yeah, we're doing okay. So today is the last episode of our mental health series.
Yes, excellent interview.
Yeah, I thought all three. I mean, I definitely.
Yeah.
As with all of our episodes, I've learned a lot, but these three in particular kind of hit home for me, and just kind of made me look a little bit deeper into where I'm at in my career and things like that. So, especially today's episode is really eye opening for me.
Yeah.
So we have Kim's interview today, Kim Speltz. You know, we're going to be talking about depression in this episode, kind of a heavy hitter, but a lot of really, really good information in there and some really good resources and just thoughts and ideas to consider. So
just the courage to come forward and say, hey, I want to talk about this.
Yeah.
Because this is not something that's easy to talk about.
Right, right. And as she says in the interview, you know, she had to name it. She had to own it. She had to decide when she wanted to talk about it. And so, you know, it is definitely something that, you know, I think a lot of people in our field, you know, when I think about some close friends and colleagues that we have, or when we read posts in groups such as the Not One More Vet support staff,
right,
you know, I feel like there's a lot of people that this episode in particular, but this whole series, will really resonate with and really hopefully help some people and give them some ideas and some resources, or if nothing else, at least let them know that they're not the only ones experiencing these kinds of things, and hopefully inspire people to, you know, as they say, make the call, whether that's to an employee assistance program that your hospital may have, or, you know, to a friend or a colleague, or just reach out for help.
Well, and also just giving, I don't want to say putting a face to it, but putting a voice to it. And talking to somebody that's made it to the other side of it, I think that's really important, because, you know, I don't think I've ever experienced something like she's describing. However, I can understand that being in the middle of that is very hard to get through, and not really realizing that there's a safe way to get through to the other side.
Right.
You know, we talk a lot about mental health issues in these last three episodes, and I feel like this one's really important to have people listen to.
Yeah, for sure. And I also want to say that for you and I, this isn't a one and done thing. Now that May is over, this isn't.
Yeah.
This isn't the last of mental health that we're going to cover. I know we've talked to some people about talking about workplace bullying and some other ideas. So we will have other episodes and look at this from a couple of different angles as well down the road. It just kind of fit with the timing.
Yeah.
I certainly learned a lot, and it gave me a lot of really, really good insight from a couple of different angles. So it's definitely something I needed to hear.
Yeah, it's really important, I think, for people to understand that there are ways to get through this, and just not feeling, you know, so alone in it. I think if I was ever dealing with something like this, I would completely internalize it and compartmentalize it, and it would be hard for me to get help, because I'm one of those people that I rarely ask for help. So, but hearing her tell the story and kind of going through her ordeal with it and how she got through it, I think is really important to understand for people.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, really important to remember it's okay to not be okay.
Right.
And you know, I thought she made a really good point as well. She says something along the lines of, you know, if you're diabetic, you take your insulin. If you're hypothyroid, yeah, you take your thyroid supplement. If you're suffering from mental health, you take an antidepressant or whatever it may be. It really is no different. And so we, you know, just want to try to break that stigma a little bit. So.
Well, and she also touched on the analogy of a patient in shock, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah,
I don't want to get too much into it because she explains it much better than I can. But that was really interesting. And I think, I don't know if she was just playing to the audience of two ECC nerds of of making it into something that was shock related. That made so much more sense for me.
For sure. You know, we also talked about an article this week that our good friend Tasha McNerney posted, and it's called The People Pleaser's Guide to Saying No, How to Set Boundaries at Work That Gain Respect Without the Guilt. And it's a little bit of a lengthy article, some really great points. And we were going to discuss it during this intro, and we decided there's so much good information in here. We want to just do like an Instagram live and talk about it, because we could really give, you know, 15, 20 minutes or more
easily,
to the article. So instead of, you know, just kind of hitting the bullet points in the intro here, I think we're just going to do a whole separate thing about it. But we'll certainly post the link to it in case you guys didn't see it on Facebook, and we'll be talking about it in a live forum soon.
Well, and this article really hit home with me because I am a people pleaser. Robin and I use the other a different term. We call me an obliger, where I feel obligated to do things that people ask me to do. I won't get too in depth into the article, but you know, the reason that people say yes to everything is they want to be part of the team. They want respect. They want love.
Yeah, affirmation, all that.
Affirmation, all that stuff. But for me, it's more of a, and I take on that role of, if I don't do it, who's going to do it? That was a really good article, and I can't wait to talk more about that.
Yeah, so we'll do that maybe this coming week or the next, and we'll go from there. But we'll post the link in this episode as well, so people can kind of look at it beforehand. But, of course, the other thing we definitely wanted to touch on is everything else that's going on
right
now. You know,
finally, COVID is not the main topic of stress in the world.
Right.
Not that we want topics of stress, but I feel like what's going on in Minneapolis and other states and other cities is more important right now. You and I talked about this, of some of the stuff that I've seen on Facebook and people showing support and things like that. And the thing that I want to bring up is that you and I are not able to say that we understand what's going on.
Right.
Yeah. We do not understand.
Really, I have no clue.
There's no way for us to understand that. We you know, I've been thinking the last few days about my life, and I went for a run yesterday out in the neighborhood around Duke, and you know, thinking to myself that for people of color, what I did was probably not safe to do, and that's just not fair, and it's just not right. Regardless of your politics, regardless of color your skin is, it's really important that we're all equal and we're all fair. You know, I don't want to.
We should be anyway.
We should be, yeah, we should be. And I don't want to discourage protests, because I realize some of the protests have turned violent. Being active in making your voice heard, no matter what color your skin is, really important. There was a protest in Raleigh yesterday that I wasn't able to make it to, but we're in tough times right now.
Yeah.
Okay. And you know, to touch on mental health again, you know, this is something that is depressing, and it really strains on our minds of like, what are we doing right now? Why are we like this?
Yeah. And, you know, we interviewed Stephen Sittall a couple months ago, and we grazed the subject a little bit, but he definitely pointed us to the multicultural VMA, which you and I both joined on Facebook. And, you know, I've been following some of the posts in there, and, you know, it's, you know, where I come from in Southern California is a very white area. I haven't had a lot of experience with people of color in our field. Certainly, you know, I see it more in the vet school. I see it more in veterinary students, but even in my job there is as a technician, not a lot of people of color. And I, as you said, like, I mean, I can't pretend to understand. I can absolutely empathize and support, but you know, and you know, we definitely wanted to say that, you know, we encourage the activism and just want to encourage people to stay safe. You know, sometimes those two maybe don't go hand in hand, but you know, but get your voice heard and contact your state representatives, contact, I mean, there's a lot of numbers floating around on Facebook and people you can email and what have you, and you know, definitely be vocal, be active, but as much as you can, be safe.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think, Dave? I think we've rambled on long enough.
I think so.
you want to get into the interview?
Yeah, let's turn these mics off and turn on the other mics.
Yeah. So anyway, we're going to go ahead and get into the interview, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe. Enjoy the episode with our guest, Kim Speltz, and hope you enjoyed the mental health series. And I hope that you guys are well and you guys are safe. Take care, guys. Our guest today is Kim Speltz, and Kim is originally a BS in aerospace engineering sciences. After spending time working for NASA and in the corporate world, went back to school and became a CVT, and we're going to talk a bit about that. Initially worked as an emergency technician and joined anesthesia department at Colorado State University's Veterinary Teaching Hospital, where she trained veterinary students, interns, residents, and other techs in anesthesia, and I have mad respect for that, working in academia myself. She became a veterinary technician specialist in anesthesia in 2004 and started her own business, Peak Veterinary Anesthesia Services, in 2013. You've probably seen her lecture at all kinds of conferences all over the country on anesthesia and pain management. She's been the Western Veterinary Conference Veterinary Technician Continuing Educator of the Year. She's also co-authored the AHA Anesthesia Guidelines for Dogs and Cats and is a contributing author to Anesthesia for Veterinary Technicians and Pain Management for Veterinary Technicians and Nurses, and was the president of the Academy of Veterinary Technicians in Anesthesia and Analgesia from 2016 to 2018. So without further ado, Kim, welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe. Thank you so much for being here. Can we get you a cup of coffee?
Oh, I would love one if it was first thing in the morning. My coffee drinking is limited to the early hours of the day. But right now, if you wanted to get me a Diet Dr. Pepper, that's my afternoon caffeinated drink.
All right. I think we can find that. I think we can scrounge
one of those up.
Yeah,
excellent.
Absolutely.
I would have to say, if I had you make me a cup of coffee, I'd be so embarrassed to tell you how much sugar to put in that coffee that I would probably just have to say, you know what, I'll get my own. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'll just do it myself. Got to do it.
Coffee with your sugar.
Exactly. That's pretty much exactly it.
Well, Dave will probably be disappointed to hear. I found a limited release of coconut flavored coffee by Dunkin' Donuts. So that's what I'm drinking right now.
I don't know how I feel about it, because I'm one of those people that I love coconut. Mm. I've never had it in a coffee, though. I'm actually
I don't think I had either. And it's actually really good.
Yeah, really, I'm not a big coconut fan, but I do love I do get the Dunkin' Donuts French vanilla coffee.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. That's a good
you
one.
Can't
coconut's
go wrong
one of those
French
polarizing
vanilla.
Things where you either love it or you hate it.
Yeah.
Nobody's indifferent to coconut. It's you either love it or you hate
it.
Yes,
absolutely.
Absolutely. It's Elvis or the Beatles. I mean, that's...
for sure.
It is that kind of argument.
Yeah. Right? So, Kim, we kind of always start off with having people talk about their career path, kind of where they started and how they got to where they're going. And I'd love to hear. I'm a huge aeronautics nut myself. I have my private pilot's license, so I would love to hear how you started out in aerospace engineering and got into veterinary medicine and got to where you are today.
And made that simple little leap there. Yeah, that's
a lot of crossover, right?
Right, exactly. when you kind of bookend it with then and now, like, it's how could you possibly even, you know, doing any sort of puzzle work, make those two connect. And so it is one of my favorite stories to tell about myself. And it's always intriguing to people when they see that. But hopefully when I kind of lay it out, maybe it won't sound quite so crazy. But yes, I do have a degree in aerospace engineering. I worked out in Southern California at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and worked on the Galileo spacecraft, which, if you guys remember, went to Jupiter. Worked for one of the science teams there, a couple of the science teams actually, and my job on that project was to take the observational times for those instruments and take the requests from the science teams and work with the other science teams to coordinate who gets to use the data when, and then create a series of upload sequences that would go up to the spacecraft. So really, I was doing a lot of project management, and that becomes relevant when we kind of talk about the career path itself. Project management on a very narrow scale. Of course, I wasn't the project manager of the whole program or anything like that. But what I did love that job. I absolutely loved it, but did not love living in Southern California so much. As a Colorado native, after 4 or 5 years out there, I was just homesick and real tired of, you know, not four seasons of not seeing snow very often and things like that. I was out there for the Northridge earthquake, and I kind of described that as the straw that broke the camel's back. And it's a, Jeff, you've lived in California. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you Californians, you're not so paranoid about these things, but that one, no pun intended, really, really shook me up. So,
Was that in 89?
That was 94, actually. Okay, 93 or 94. Now I'm showing my age because I can't even remember when this when this event happened. But anyway, you know, it just kind of drove home that, you know, it wasn't where I wanted to be. And if I could absolutely have that job in Colorado, I would have done it. So I started looking. I looked for aerospace jobs back in Colorado. And I'm also a Gen Xer, so this will become relevant as well. When you realize that as a Gen Xer, I was pretty idealistic about what I was willing to do and the way I was willing to use my knowledge. And so I was definitely only interested in science-based activities and had no interest in applying my engineering skills to military or military contractors or anything like that.
Sure.
For which there were plenty of jobs doing that. And as it turns out, not so many in the science field. So it was very difficult. I ended up taking a job for a software development company, a little startup software development company in Boulder, doing some project management for them. And so that's where I kind of got my first taste of job translatable skills, right? Like aerospace engineering to this software development company, it isn't the job title, but it's actually the job skill that
sure.
translates over. And that has held true with me through this whole path. So I love that job too. A little startup company in Boulder. You could imagine, you know, shorts and t-shirts and sandals to work. There are 25 employees and it was pretty fantastic. And then within about a year and a half, we'd been bought and sold a couple times, moved corporate offices to a suburb of Denver, closer to the Denver metro area. And you know, we have cubicles and dress codes and totally not a Boulder startup company anymore. Right. And I always like to
big
describe
culture
it as
change.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. My life had become a Dilbert cartoon at that point. And so also going back to the Gen X thing, I got pretty disillusioned that I was making a whole bunch of money for somebody else and didn't really feel like I was giving back or like I wasn't feeling like I was part of anything, right? Except just being a cog in a wheel and again, making a lot of money for someone else. And so I kind of had my first midlife crisis in my late 20s and was trying to figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up. That's when I went back to one of the options for me growing up or certainly when I was in high school and the route that I took in college was biological sciences and veterinary medicine. And that certainly had weighed on my mind back then. And I chose the more engineering and mathematical route instead. And so I started really thinking then about going to vet school.
Hmm.
Then after, you know, realizing that I'd been out of school long enough and would have to go back and repeat a couple of years of undergrad probably, and then apply to vet school. And if I got in, then it's another 4 years. And if I graduated, which I'm sure I would, then we're looking at an internship and a residency because God knows I'm an overachiever. And I wouldn't just come out with a simple DVM. And now we're looking at hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt and, you know. So I decided to go to veterinary technician school. And I went to Bel Ray in Denver as a way to kind of dip my toes in the water. I figured I could always go back to vet school if I wanted. And I just fell in love with it. I fell in love with being a technician. I have been just absolutely blessed with fantastic employers and great jobs that have been challenging. And when I got the job, I was in emergency medicine at first while I was in school and for a year out of school, then landed the job at Colorado State University. Really as a foot in the door, I wanted to work in their critical care unit, who was not hiring, but the anesthesia department wasn't. And I literally made this statement to somebody when I found this out of, well, how can somebody make a job out of running anesthesia all day? Like, what do you do? Do you just sit there and you make dots and dashes on a piece of paper? And I laugh so hard at myself now because that's obviously not what we do, but it does kind of tell you the limited amount of exposure to this particular specialty that we have in tech school, or at least that we did when I went through school. So boy, within a week I was hooked. And that was 2000. I took that job at CSU in 2000. And here we are 20 years later, and I've been doing nothing else but anesthesia and just loving every minute of it.
That's awesome. You know, I want to say really quick, Dave, I think I know why you thought 89 for that earthquake, because the one in the world during the World Series.
But that was the Loma Prieta quake. Yeah.
That was the other end of the state.
My mind is always in baseball. So.
I know. I was going to say, well, I know Jeff is really itching for some sports going on here.
But, yeah, we both are. We're going a little crazy with it.
Yeah.
I have one of my clients that I work with is also a huge sports fan, and he told me the other day, he's like, I'm just going to start watching NASCAR. I got to have something.
Well, I think they are going to have NASCAR races.
They are. I'm a huge NASCAR fan. It starts next weekend. Yeah.
Yep.
So, Kim, I know we're going to kind of get down deep into some other topics here, but I want to talk a little bit about PEAK and what that is and what you do with that and what that kind of looks like for you.
Yeah. So that was it is an acronym. Okay. So, of course, here in Colorado, you know, it's always PEAK something or PEAK this or PEAK that. And particularly here in Colorado Springs with Pikes Peak in our backyard, there's a lot of peaks here. But it stands for Providing Exceptional Anesthesia Knowledge. I started this business in 2013. I worked for a board-certified veterinary anesthesiologist after I left CSU, starting in 2005. And he had an anesthesia and pain management business here in Colorado Springs, which he closed down in fall of 2013. And I found myself suddenly without a job in my late 40s, being highly specialized, not knowing what I was going to do next. And, you know, I could have gone back to the university. I could have gone into emergency medicine again. I could have done a lot of things, but I really didn't want to stop doing what I was doing. And so I took the opportunity, I rolled the dice, and I started my own kind of consulting and training and case assistance business, which is PEAK. And so I kind of call it, instead of working for one employer, I work for several. You know, so I go around to different clinics and help them with higher risk anesthesia cases. I do staff training. I can either do that as didactic training, or I can actually go in and help supervise staff and talk about cases in real time. Just a lot of flexibility there. And it has been incredibly well received here in the Colorado Springs area, and I do some things up in Denver as well. But it has really allowed me to continue doing what I love to do, and it was really one of the first technician-based business models, I think, that kind of broke out of the normal path that we tend to take as veterinary technicians. And it's been extremely successful in its concept. You know, I'm not a millionaire by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm able to support myself and keep a paycheck coming in and things like that. And just the personal reward of veterinarians being so thankful and technicians being so thankful and providing that high level of anesthetic care and really working within my community to raise the standards of care for our patients has just been so incredibly rewarding. And it's been wildly successful from that personal standpoint, you know, going back to my midlife crisis in my 20s, where I didn't feel like I was giving back and I didn't feel a part of anything. I feel so a part of what I do and helping some of these animals get through procedures that maybe they wouldn't be able to get through otherwise.
That's awesome.
And Kim, is this like your main job right now, or is this, for lack of a better term, your side hustle?
No, this is my primary job right now. Although I'm also co-owners of a veterinary technician school here in Colorado Springs called Apex College of Veterinary Technology. And we just finally got all of our accreditation in line last fall and started taking financial aid this year. So we're really awesome. On the precipice of taking off here at the school as well.
And in terms of PEAK, is that just you or do you have a staff?
It's just me right now. I am very, very interested in finding the right person to help me out. In fact, I do have a cohort who's in the process of applying for his VTS right now, who's helping me out. But yeah, it's been me, and it's been sometimes 70 to 90 hour work weeks if it's particularly busy being on call at the emergency clinic and stuff. So, and it's been tremendously educational for me about just running a business, you know, of marketing and the financial side of things and doing invoicing and all of these things. And I am the HR manager and the CEO and the CFO, and I'm the head technician, and I am, you know, I'm the, all of the things on this. And so, yeah, I wear a lot of hats.
Yeah. It sounds like you have a lot of hats to wear.
Yeah.
Hopefully you don't have to take yourself to HR too often.
Not too often, but I tell you what, I've written myself up a couple of times. So one more and I'm out the door. I tell you what.
Well, Kim, there's really a lot in your bio and your career path that we could devote pretty much entire episodes to.
Seriously, I could talk about aerospace for like another hour.
Let's do it.
However, this is our mental health series because May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and you contacted us about your journey and how you went through things. So we want to focus on mental health and.
Yeah.
You know, mental health is a huge challenge in the field right now, especially with what we're dealing with COVID and, you know, people that are, we've talked about this in other episodes about the struggles that people that are dealing with normally are going through and now are exacerbated by all the stress of COVID and all the changes in the workplace and all these other things. But you mentioned to us that you battled with depression. So how did you begin to recognize that? Do you want to talk about that a little bit before we start asking a bunch of questions about it?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think just from looking back at my bio and the things that I've done, I mean, obviously I'm highly ambitious, highly motivated individual with very high standards for myself and high expectations for myself and traditionally what I would consider being successful or not successful. And all of that kind of started to catch up with me around 2015, kind of early on there. So the business was really taking off. I was lecturing a lot. I was traveling a lot. I had a, you know, very widely known persona, public persona. I had been elected president-elect of the ABTAA and was set to take that over in 2016. And the straw that broke my back in that was we had had some deaths in the family leading up to early 2015. The most recent one being a kind of one of my soulmate dogs who died late in 2014 from an IBD flare-up back in July of that year that we couldn't get on top of. And so this was a very special dog to me, and he died of a disease that, as we know, isn't typically a fatal disease. Mm. And it just hit me, boy, just like a kick in the gut. And we'll get to therapy and stuff like that. But, you know, one of the things that I realized as I went through that process is, you know, grief is not just about a single event of grief. And so it wasn't just, you know, his death that was this triggering factor. It was his loss and the loss of my job a couple of years before that and the loss of some family members in the couple of years before that as well. And so, you know, grief is grief, whether it's a person or an animal or a job or like what we're going through right now, grief of a loss of a normal way of life and all of the changes and stuff like that. So what happened for me is I got pretty dark and was really struggling to keep my head above water. I remember very specifically in that spring, my partner and I were at an Ani DiFranco concert. He was one of my favorite artists. I've seen her over 40 times. And she played a song that night that I'd never heard before. And it was called Allergic to Water. And anybody who's out there who knows this song and struggles with depression will know that this song just the perfect summary of all of that. And the gist of the song is, you know, how can you be allergic to water? You know, what's wrong with you? This is something that's so normal. You know, what's going on? Why can't you, how can you possibly not drink water? You know? And I just remember sitting at this, in this show, with just tears streaming down my face, just tears pouring down my face over how much these verses were hitting home to me. And one of the last lines of the song, she talks about this is me doing the best that I can. And she got done singing and I just turned to my partner in tears and I said, I'm doing the best that I can. And realizing at that moment that if this was the best that I was doing, I was in real trouble. You know, because it was, you know, I wasn't up to the edge. I wasn't, you know, peering over the cliff edge, but I was close enough that I was feeling the breeze coming up from the chasm, you know.
Sure.
And within a week, I had gotten myself into therapy and she was a therapist and she sent me to a psychiatrist and got on some antidepressants, and that was the start of my realization that I needed to do something to change what was going on.
In kind of talking then there about how you're beginning to recognize this as you kind of start to think about it more and more, and what other aspects of your life or what other aspects of your career or what have you, did anything else come to mind like, oh my gosh, this is a part of it as well, and this is a part of it as well? Like how?
Oh yeah, Jeff, it is all tied together. It's all tied together, you know, and one of the things that people who are really driven in our profession do, we work all the time. We work extra shifts. We stay late past our end time. We sign up to lecture at every conference that we can. We do so many things. And for me at the time, you know, running my own business, I was taking whatever jobs I could get because, you know, goodness knows, when is the money going to dry up? You know, when is the business going to fail? Yeah. And so from a professional standpoint, a lot of that overworking that we put ourselves through, it's a coping mechanism that some of us have to run away from ourselves. It's like a numbing behavior. If you're familiar with Brené Brown's work, where she talks about numbing behavior, you know, some people might numb themselves with alcohol, some numb themselves with overwork. It's all of these tools that we have of not taking the time to sit and reflect on ourselves, right? Of avoiding what's going on. And so for me at the time, professionally, that was certainly a part of it. It was a way for me to escape from the feelings that I had about myself, that I was failing. You know, why did I feel like this? This isn't normal. There must be something wrong with me. So there was that. That's how my professional life tied into it. My personal life, you know, shutting down on relationships, not like actively pushing people away, but just not engaging as much, right? Sure. Not engaging in that vulnerability that you need to really have meaningful relationships. My partner and I, within that first year too, we're in therapy together, and that was very beneficial for us. And then as time went on over the next few years, all of that stuff continued to catch up with me. And so I started, in my mind, failing at some things professionally. You know, when I took over the AVTAA, I was not in the right headspace. And there was a lot going on in the industry with changes at NAFTA and changes in the CVTS, and the VNI got started, and all of these big things that I was at the helm of the AVTAA to kind of navigate our way through. And I had nothing left in the tank to do that sort of stuff. So, you know, and some people in the AVTAA kind of know my story, and others don't. But that was really, through the next few years, one of the biggest professional failures that I still carry with me. And I don't say that in a self-judgmental way, knowing what I was going through at the time, but it eventually catches up with you, you know? And, you know, you look at somebody like the Louise O'Dwyer, near and dear to our hearts, you know, like when I read her story, and Louise and I weren't close friends, but we were acquaintances, you know, we ran in the same circles, and we would see each other at conferences and stuff. But when I read her story, like, it just hit so close to home, because she was on the same path that I was on, you know, of high expectations for herself, never turning down a job, wanting to succeed or being viewed as successful. And when we internalize that, and we rely so much on how we think others perceive us to be, instead of really diving deep into our own self-awareness and our own self-acceptance, that's when we can get into trouble.
You know, you said in there, our last episode, we had Joe DiFullio on, and he was talking about compassion fatigue. And the phrase that he used was, you can't pour from an empty cup.
Right.
And it sounds like that's kind of where you were, you know. And I think too, you know, talking about, many of us in this field are driven to succeed and overachievers and things of that sort. And I, you know, in my time, I've only been there for coming up on 4 years now in academia. I see so many veterinary students that, you know, are, I don't know, 24, 25, 26 years old. And I see where they're at now. And that's ultimately what their motivation is. That's why they've gotten into vet school. And that's why they're, you know, going to be ultimately successful. And oh boy, I just worry about some of them.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's empty cup theory, you know, Jeff and I both got contacted by Liz Houston about taking over as, what is the term?
Oh yeah, the admin for ER Vet Tech Rounds.
To be admins for ER Vet Tech Rounds. And I got the text from Liz, and I said, oh, that sounds like something great to do. And, you know, I turned to Robin, my girlfriend, and she says, if you take on one more project that is going to stress you out more, I probably will kill you.
Yeah.
So it's definitely that self-awareness and being able to realize that there are things that we do have to say no to, and yeah. There are limits to everything that we can do. You know, Jeff and I are doing the podcast, and, yep. You know, I'm teaching, and teaching is stressful, and trying to do other things and all the stuff that we have to do. And, you know, one more opportunity shows up and, you know, you want to do it. Like, I really wanted to do that, but just thinking about, is that going to take away from something else that I'm trying to work on? And is that right. going to make me more stressed yeah. out?
Yeah. Right. That's exactly right. And, yeah. you know, and I've spent the last, you know, year and a half of really diving deep into not doing things, into not seeking out yeah. things. You know, sure. I did, when Katie Waddell took over for the ABTAA presidency, I did bow down of being past president. You know, I said I told her, I was upfront with her, like, my head's not in the right place. And I think that, you guys would be better off without me trying to hold this position. That was a big move for me.
Sure,
but yeah. I also, you know, I also quit focusing on business development for Peak. You know, I wanted to have this online training program up and going for years. And I just put the brakes on that. Like, I don't have the fuel in the tank, as you said, you yeah. know, and yeah. I have not applied to speak at any conferences for the last year. And it's been such a relief for me to allow myself some space for personal development and personal yeah. growth. A lot of the work that I've been doing in the past year has been around vulnerability and self-awareness and things like that. But this idea of vulnerability, which, again, you know, Brené Brown talks a lot about vulnerability and the importance of being vulnerable, but it all starts with being vulnerable with yourself, right? Yeah. And when you're vulnerable with yourself, it means that you have to look inward, and you have to look inward without judgment. Brené Brown actually did an interview with David Kessler, who's a grief expert, on her podcast, and he talks about how judgment demands punishment. And I was on a walk with the dogs when I heard that quote, and I just stopped and I put it in my notes on my phone, because it just rings so true for me. Because I think a lot of us who struggle with depression, one of the big problems is we judge ourselves. And again, yeah. we ask, what's wrong with us? You know, everybody else seems to have their lives together. Everybody else seems to be managing just fine. I can't even get out of bed in the morning.
Right,
you know, yeah. I can't even find the strength to get to the shower when my hair's all greasy. And so we put a lot of judgment on ourselves. And when we judge ourselves, or when we judge anybody else, anytime we're judging, that demands punishment. And so we punish ourselves a lot. Yeah. If we are judging others, we think there's something wrong with them, and we think that they need to be punished. You know, and this idea of self-judgment and self-punishment just is such a big key of, or was for me anyway, in the spiral down.
Yeah.
And so I think, when going back to the vulnerability thing, vulnerability starts with being vulnerable with yourself and recognizing your strengths and recognizing your limits and recognizing what it looks like when you are on the path that you're supposed to be and what it looks like when you're not, and giving yourself the freedom to try again, I guess, you know, and I, you know, sometimes I wonder, you know, what kept me from going all the way to the edge? You know, what is the difference between me and the person who crossed that edge, you know? And I don't know what that is, but it scares me nonetheless.
Sure.
You know, I've had, let's see, in the last 5 years, two veterinarians that I've worked with directly have taken their lives. A technician has taken her own life. And then, you know, every time I see the articles come across, it triggers me, because yeah. I know what it's like to be so close. And I also know what it's like, thankfully, to pull back. And,
yeah.
and it always shakes me just a little bit, because, you know, what's the next thing? What's the next hole going to be like?
Right.
Because that's, you know, that's going to come too.
Yeah. You know, hearing that, one thing I think about when you kind of talk about there, the idea that, you know, hard to get out of bed and hard to get to the shower. And I can imagine, when you're in that place and everything is, even some of the seemingly most mundane things are just so monumental.
Yeah, they call it the impossible task.
Okay,
capital
yeah.
I, capital T in okay. depression world. Yeah.
How then I mean, it must be 1,000 times that in terms of difficulty to try to confront it.
Oh, yeah.
And say, okay, it's time for me to do something about this. Like, I can't even imagine then how difficult that would be.
Yeah, it's overwhelming. And, you know, so many people post such positive things about, you know, you're not alone and please call and I'm here for you if you need it. And God knows we need those messages. But it's also important for people to understand that when you were in that state, you know, the times that I have been in that place, like I've never felt like there weren't a dozen people I couldn't call up at a moment's notice and say, I am in it right now. Like, I need you. It's not that I felt alone. It's sure. that I felt so tired, just so exhausting. Like yeah. just the thought of having that conversation with somebody was just too much. It's just too much.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, those, you know, if those normal day-to-day tasks are so heavy on us, then how do we get our heads around it? And, right. and I don't have the answer for it, except you just do it breath by breath yeah. and day by day. And for me, it was week by week for a little bit, you know, going to therapy. And it's the tiniest, most incremental changes. And that can be frustrating, too, because you know what? You go to the shrink and you get your prescription and you take your pill and you're like, cool, my depression is over. You know, this is working for me. And then a month later or a year later, you find yourself in a spiral again. And what they don't tell you when you're starting to confront your depression and deal with your depression is that it never goes away. It's never gone. And one of my very, very good friends who also struggles with this had this amazing analogy. It's like you live near water. Okay. You live near a body of water. Maybe it's the ocean or whatever. And you can never leave. You can never move away from that. The water never recedes, you know, and sometimes you're just walking along in wet sand. And sometimes the water's kind of lapping at your ankles. And sometimes it feels like the water's going to come in and sweep you away. But the water never goes away. You know, mm-hmm. sometimes you're up on the dunes. Sometimes you're on the wet sand. Sometimes you're on your nice balcony, listen to the peaceful waves crashing on the shore. But it's never completely gone.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that was kind of a hang up for me for a while and a frustration as I was getting healthier, that I would periodically have these, albeit very short and not nearly as deep, little episodes until I finally came to terms with, it doesn't ever go away. It's just a matter of how far away it is. And, you know, recognizing the pattern of getting through those events. So that as time goes on, I'm stringing along, you know, weeks and months now of no little dips, or not, at least not very significant ones, but it's a process and it's a long process.
Sure.
And I think that's what can seem so overwhelming too for people is that if I can't even get it out of bed, how can I make the phone call? How can I go to therapy? I don't know. I don't know what it is, but it was maybe it was the ambition. Maybe it was just the stubbornness that I inherited from my grandfather and my mother, you know, that, you know, just like, well, dang it, I'm going to give this one last go. You know, like I can't not exhaust all my options. I've probably had some truly rational, logical left brain engineering pathway that I made through making that decision. But it's time consuming, but it is, and it's energy sucking, but it is what you got to do, you know,
yeah.
or you don't. And, you know, I don't fault people for making the different decision than I made. I don't judge them for that because I know how tired they must have been to get to that point. And
well, and also that analogy that you gave of living by a body of water, that must also make it so much more difficult to deal with because you're dealing with this big heavy weight and dealing with the depression and then suddenly realizing that it's not going to go away. You know, you think you're going to go get treatment.
I actually had the opposite. I think for me, realizing that, you know, when my friend told me this analogy, I'm like, you know what, that makes such perfect sense now because now the expectation isn't that,
oh yeah,
I'm going to go away. You know, now the expectation right. isn't there that, oh my God, I'm sad again today. Or I had this, I had a little two steps forward, one step back. Now it's much easier for me to accept like, oh, okay, well, the tide's just in today, you know,
yeah,
and the tide will go out again tomorrow. So for me, it was actually very empowering to to get that, because it allowed me to release a lot of resistance I felt around having this condition and being treated for it and expecting everything to just be hunky-dory. Mm. Now I've got a lot more freedom around the headspace surrounding it. So
yeah, I hadn't thought of it in that way. That does make more sense to realize that it's not something you're going to get rid of, but it's something that you can keep at bay and you know, move further away from if you possibly can.
Right. Exactly.
So, you know, you talked about going to therapy and things like that. So in terms of the steps that you took towards working on this, what worked, what didn't work? I realized therapy probably was a big help, but was there other things that you needed to do that you may not have expected to do that seemed to work?
And
how did that go?
I think, you know, the very first thing that helped, and therapy was great. I wasn't in it long term. And certainly I will call my therapist up now and again if I feel like I need a little tune-up, as we like to call it. But therapy was just the first step. Therapy was the first step, getting my head around some things and then getting on the appropriate medication and the appropriate dose of medication and understanding the limits and how, you know, this isn't a pill to fix your problems. It's just a pill to kind of stabilize your emotion and things like that. But then for me, it became very, very important to talk about it. You know, I think mental health in general carries a huge negative weight, both in how we feel about our own mental health issues and how a lot of people feel about seeing it in someone else. You know, I think there is a lot of judgment out there. And for me to really start to come out of it, I had to own it. I had to name it. I had to talk about it. I had to joke about it. It made my partner very uncomfortable at first when I started talking about taking my antidepressant every morning. I'd talk about, oh, I got to go take my crazy pill. And there would just be this silence, you know, and eventually I just kept saying it. I just kept at it. And now, you know, several years later, she'll say in the morning, like, hey, did you take your crazy today? And I'm like, yeah, I took my crazy pill. So it was, you know, naming things and using some humor in appropriate ways to get your head around things and to not make them so big was really important. And then, you know, opening up to other friends and stuff and sharing stories with others in this field in particular and the specific challenges that we face in veterinary medicine that can kind of contribute to some of these feelings. That was a huge step. That was a huge step for me. Mm. The other thing I really had to start looking at was my own self-talk, both, you know, what my internal dialogue was saying, as well as what I would joke about to other people, you know, this kind of self-deprecating humor, which God knows has traditionally been a huge part of my comedic repertoire, is my own self-deprecating humor. I got hooked on a book called You Are a Badass by Jen Sincero, and I've read it, gosh, three times now, I think, in the last 2 or 3 years. And one of the points she makes in that book is doing away with self-deprecating humor, because it's really not all that funny. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Of course it's funny. It's hilarious. And and through, again, this self-exploration, you know, when we say things over and over, even if we mean them in a joking manner, some part of our brain does actually internalize that. And so I have made a conscious effort the last couple of years last year really, to do away with so much self-deprecating humor, because somewhere inside of me, I am internalizing that. And that is manifesting, you know, that can potentially manifest itself as a sense of failure and things like that. So I think letting go of that self-deprecating humor, letting go of a lot of the judgment for myself of perceived failures in my professional life, and just being with my own thoughts and being with my own feelings has been great. One of the tools that has helped me with that is meditation. Mm. I use an app called Headspace. And this is another one of those things that it took a few years to stick. I would try it and I'd do well for a week or a month and then I wouldn't. And now I've got like a 220-day run streak of meditation, daily meditation. And that has been, oh man, so key for me in just being more present moment to moment, you know, not being anxious about what's coming up, not being depressed about what happened yesterday. You know, it's given me a better frame of mind in managing moment to moment and being with my thoughts and my emotions and the task that I'm doing right now, it's made me less reactive. It's made me less judgmental. It has really been key to my recovery the past year or so. And again, it's hard to train the mind to sit and be still. And that's why I like this app so much, is because there are different, you know, it's got different packs that you can do, you know, one's for balance and one's for self-awareness. And, you know, one is for self-esteem. And then there's, you know, other things having to do with performance. And so it really has different visualizations and different tools for depending on what you're trying to achieve. And for me, it was so key to just quiet the mind, to just settle down and realize that you are not your thoughts. You are not your feelings. Yes, they're a part of you, but they are not you. You know, they're just manifestations of your, sometimes it's your lizard brain that's talking to you. Sometimes it's other parts of your brain that are trying to dominate the dialogue. So that I would give meditation a double thumbs up for its role for me the last 6 months to a year, for sure. Mm.
Wow. You know, you said in there having to own it and talk about it. When you begin to talk about something like this with friends and family and especially colleagues, you know, you start to talk about your depression and the battle that you're waging. What's the response to that? I mean, I feel like a lot of, like you said earlier, a lot of people in this profession are, you know, are of the mindset, like, if you ever need anything, I'm here. And that's not always the most helpful. But when you start talking about this, how did you find people started reacting to that? Were they supportive, or did you ever encounter any negativity or anything like that?
I haven't, but you know what? I didn't start talking about it till I was ready to talk about it.
Sure.
And a good analogy is, like, people are like dogs, right? They smell fear, you know, and you know, we do. We have this tendency to want to run away from people talking about experiences that we fear, or that we fear might happen to us, or that we fear might happen to us again. And so, you know, if I were to come to this conversation and say, I really want to talk to you about something, and I've been struggling with depression, and you know, in kind of hemming and hawing around it, I don't actually really bring it up like that. You know, there might be some other conversation that has to do with something else, and I talk about taking an antidepressant every day, or I talk about, ooh, yeah, there was a time when things were real dark for me too. And it's building it into conversation at the right point, but it's also building it into conversation because I'm ready to have the conversation, right? And I'm gotcha. And I'm not self-apologetic about it, and I'm not going to protect your feelings about my experience, because if you want to listen to my experience, I'll tell you about it, but I'm not going to hide my experience because I want to talk about it and you don't want to hear it, or you're afraid of hearing about it.
Right.
That also doesn't mean that I want to put a sticker on my car that says, you know, depressed and proud, you know, or anything like that. That's not it either.
Sure.
But again, it's coming back to that self-awareness and that lack of judgment. And this is just like, you know, if I were diabetic, I'd be taking insulin. You know, if I was hypothyroid, yeah, yeah, I'd be taking a thyroid pill. Well, sure. I just happen to have a little bit wonky brain chemistry that puts me in dark places, and so I take a pill for that. So it's really not any different in my head than that. And I think that comes across, or at least I hope it comes across when I do talk to people about it, because I'm not embarrassed by it anymore. Right. Yeah. You know?
And did you find people that were maybe like, you know, I was wondering if something was wrong or something was going on, I just didn't know how to ask. Did you find that there were people that were like, I thought maybe there was something going on, or was it really just something that you were battling so silently nobody else even picked up
on? I think I was battling it silently. You know, I had my public persona, I had my armor on, and therefore I got up and I went to work every day and I had my public face on, and I would come home and I would go to bed early, or I'd cry, or I would drink too much, or, you know, whatever. I would binge watch Netflix, you know, or play video games, you know, any sort of numbing behavior to not have to deal with what was going on in my own head. The public didn't see that. And I've always been a pretty private person anyway, you know, very introverted, hard to read, you know, I'm not a hugger. Hey, Liz Houston, I know you are. And, you know, I'll give you a hug next time I see you if we don't have the COVID. But, you know, I'm a bit prickly to begin with, and that comes across. And so I am not one to really openly discuss things kind of willy-nilly. Right. And so in answer to your question, Jeff, like nobody's ever really come up and said, yeah, I kind of wondered if something was wrong. But I will say that the friends, you know, that I have now who know about this, they can hear tones in my Facebook posts or in my text messages or whatever. And they will reach out and say, hey, how are you doing? Cause you don't sound good, you know? Mm-hmm. So these are people who either have struggled with the same things, or they are in tune with my own struggle, or for whatever reason, you know, people who know me and know this about me will reach out if they interpret things that I say or the way in which I say them as being kind of warning signs. And that's heartwarming, you know, and it's another way that I can then self-reflect, like, oh, you know, I didn't think so, but yeah, now that you mention it, you know, maybe I forgot to take my crazy pill this morning. You know, so,
in terms of, you know, the grand scope of how many people are dealing with depression, chances are there's a number of people that are listening that are probably struggling with this as well, just the same as you were. What would you give them as advice? Is there any tips to like recognize it? Any tips to, you know, get on top of it ahead of time? Is there any advice or even resources that you can give? I know you talked about the Headspace app and some of the other things, but is there anything that you want to give our listeners something to start to deal with this and start to recognize it and start to get ahead of it?
You know, the best advice I can give is to just be patient and know yourself. Take the time, you know, take the time to self-reflect and not dwell on what other people think, you know, dwell on what you think of you and dwell on what is worth your time and effort. And your time and effort is worth it to you to find your way, you know, and the way is there. It seems overwhelming, but the way is there, you know. I think employers can be better in touch with their employees, you know, watching for people. Who's the one that's always staying late? Who's the one that's always picking up extra shifts? You know, who's the one who's normal, bouncy and energetic and just seemed blah lately? You know, encouraging better work-life balance activities. For me, it was so internalized. You know, I find it hard to say, oh, well, this, you know, you should meditate because that totally worked for me. Well, that's not going to work for everybody. You know, therapy was totally beneficial to me. If you don't land on the right therapist, it can actually be detrimental to your recovery, you know? So these are the things that worked for me. They may or may not work for you, but you have to find what works for you.
Right.
You have to be vulnerable with yourself. You have to be self-aware, and you have to stop passing judgment.
Yeah.
And take your crazy pill every day.
Step one.
Don't forget.
So earlier you used the analogy of you know, the body of water and the tide going in and the tide coming out, the idea that this is something that's never going to go away. You just, you know, it's kind of, you know, always just there. Are there things that you recognize yourself, either personally or professionally, or things that you do that you might think to yourself, uh-oh, maybe I'm getting into a bad place? Are there habits you revert to? Are there signs that you see something brewing in yourself that's not putting you in a good place?
Yeah.
Or is it just kind of come on and it's like, oh, shoot, how did I get here?
You know, it used to. It used to just kind of come on. And now with the, you know, these few years of experience, now I can recognize patterns a little bit better. I tend to want to find ways to engineer smallness. If I could just throw out one more Brené Brown
of course.
Term. I find ways to engineer smallness in myself. So I don't live in vulnerability. I don't live in the arena, to bring it back to Brené Brown. But there are things like these numbing behaviors. You know, I just came off of a 90-day booze cleanse where I recognize the times that I would want to have drinks and why I would want to have those drinks really has to do with this engineering smallness and numbing myself from what's going on. And can I just say, for the record, like, I started this cleanse January 15th. Do you know how hard it has been to go through all of the stress and crazy from COVID and not be able to numb myself just a little bit from all of this nuttiness? But those are the things that I start looking for. So I start looking for myself actively finding ways to avoid my life, you know, whether it's through craving alcohol, whether it is through watching more TV than normal, whether it is through just not even wanting to take the dogs for a walk. You know, those are the big red flags for me that I will have to take active steps to overcome that before I passively fall back into that trap. And in my defense, like those times are so much fewer and farther between than they used to be, but I have to be on top of it, you know, because the water's always there and I do have some ability to navigate that water. But, you know, if I let myself just sit there and not pay attention to what's going on, then pretty soon my lawn chair is floating out on the surf and don't want to be there again.
Yeah. I think Dave said earlier on, you know, talking about where we are at these days, and you just mentioned COVID as well. Have you found it any more difficult to navigate things for you personally with everything that's going on in the world? Has it made it any more difficult or still just kind of?
I don't know. I think it's been difficult for all of us. Sure. And I don't think I certainly haven't had the difficulty that others have had. You know, my family has been healthy. I lived with the same fear that everybody else did for the first, you know, couple or 3 weeks. And I am still working. I've continued to work through March and April, you know, had a couple of scares with potential exposures, nothing of which panned out. I think for me, I am so glad this happened this year and not last year or the year before, because I think I would have not been prepared at all to deal with this. And I think for me, being off alcohol at the time, for me, having a nice run of meditation going has given me the tools to better manage my fear and my uncertainty than I probably would have had a year ago. But it's been tough, you know, and it's been the other thing that I've noticed that's grown in me is my empathy, or at least my outward manifestation of empathy, which anybody who knows me who's listening to this is going to laugh, but it's just like, well, where the hell did this come from? You know, like I don't usually typically care too much about what's happening to everybody else, but I've been just filled with empathy for people who are going through this struggle of maybe they've lost their job, maybe they've had somebody close to them die, maybe they've been sick and in the hospital, maybe they've, you know, all of these things that I just feel so bad for everybody. But it is an empathy that is not taking over for me. Like before, I would have been so sad about the state of the world that I'm gonna drink myself into a stupor so that I don't have to face it, you know. Right. Now I care about what's going on in the world. I feel empathy without it reflecting back on me as something that I need to fix, you know, that or something that I need to hide in myself. I can sit with that sadness, and I can sit with that empathy, and I can sit with my own fear and have them all sit there together without it feeling like it is driving me underground.
Well, we're just getting close to running out of time here. I know we've taken up already a solid hour of your time, but I just want to ask if there's anything else that we haven't covered yet that, you know, you want to get out there to listeners that might be spectrum.
I'll bring it back to kind of a medical analogy and something to watch for, even if you're not in that dark hole, watch for signs leading up to that. So think about when a patient gets hit by a car and comes into our hospital, right? There's that early compensatory shock that goes on where all the vital signs are normal potentially. And everything is coasting along until suddenly they can't compensate anymore, right? And so that's kind of how I feel like I was, you know, early on in this. I was in compensatory shock for a lot of things until suddenly I found myself in multi-organ failure without any recollection of how I got from point A to point G, right? And yet there I was. And so watching for those signs of overreach and overwhelm and signs that we are working as a numbing behavior and working as a way to fulfill ourselves when we need to be looking inward for that fulfillment and that healing. We're not going to get it from being great at our jobs. I mean, I've been great at my job for a long time, and all of that greatness was not enough to fulfill that. So just be cognizant that you might not be here. You might not ever get here, but just recognize that when you are of a certain mindset of ambition and willing to work crazy hours and things like that, just make sure you're not doing it because you're running from something.
The compensatory shock analogy, that's
fantastic.
That's incredible, yeah. Especially like for our field. That is absolutely yeah. so relatable.
Wow. And a couple of shock nerds too. We
yeah.
I know you are. I know you are. Don't let yourself get into DIC.
Right.
Well, and yeah. I think about, you know, when you say like filling your life with working extra shifts and being super ambitious, it's almost like you're, I don't want to say you're cognizant of the depression that's going on, but it's almost like you realize that that's happening in the background, but it almost allows you to put that whole part of you on pause, mm-hmm. To say, I'm going to work extra shifts. I'm going to focus on this and this and this and this, and this thing that's on my list to get dealt with is just going to have to wait.
Right.
Which is probably the worst thing.
Yeah.
Right.
To
put all that on pause, because, you know, as you've said, if you go down that hole, then everything else stops and you're in big trouble.
Right. Mm. Right. So, you know, a little fluid therapy, a little pain medication.
Yeah. Yeah. A little vital signs. So
maybe some mask oxygen, you know, oxygen's never contraindicated.
So true.
That's a fantastic analogy. I love
it. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Kim, thank you so much. This has been one of my favorite episodes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I appreciate you being so open and so honest with your struggle and talking about it, because I feel like, you know, there's a lot of our listeners that are probably dealing with this at this very moment. And
I mean, we have good data that says that a lot of people in our field
exactly.
are. I mean, it's just the reality.
And I hope that we can, you know, bring this to light and beat the stigma. That's the hashtag that we're using, is beat the stigma.
Beat the stigma. That's a good one.
And to try and just help people get through this, because mental health is something we're focusing on this month, and not even just this month. Like I think we've had many episodes where we kind of focus on some of the mental health aspects of our jobs and of our lives. And I feel like this kind of brought everything kind of to light
of
somebody that's actually dealt with this and gotten
well,
it to
and
the,
it was important. And, you know, when I reached out to Jeff, that was exactly what I was thinking. And, you know, as part of this, you know, naming it stop letting it control you, and you take control of it. You know, you can't heal it if you don't feel it. And, you know, I have been interested in being more public with my story because of the lives that we have lost. Yeah. You know, the ones that are big names and the ones that aren't such big names. Yeah. And I think because we're not talking about it, we're not dealing with it. And, you know, that was one of my driving reasons for reaching out to you guys, because I think we got to talk about it, you know, and we got to talk about our successes and not just our failures.
I take the power back.
Take the power back. Right. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, we are not completely done. We do still.
Oh no! See, I thought I was going to have this really vulnerable conversation. We could skip these embarrassing, put you on the spot kinds of questions.
No, we're not going to do that.
We want to at least have a little bit
of fun and end on a good note.
Yeah.
All right. Sweet. Are you ready for your would you rather question?
I am ready. I'm ready.
Okay. Would you rather be 4'5" or 7'7", and why?
Oh, I would not go back to being short. Not that I ever was. I would take 7 feet 7 inches any day. I'm 5'10" now, and boy, I wouldn't trade being tall for anything.
You know, when I looked at this, when Dave put this in the notes, I was like, you know, there are days I really wish I was short. If I hit my head one more time on a light at work.
I will take all of the hitting my head on lights just to not ever have to get a step stool out to be in surgery.
That's true. That's great. All right, Kim. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We hope that you continue to do well, and we hope that if somebody out there that's listening, you know, benefits from hearing this. And
I hope so too.
Gets on a good path, and And yeah, and thank you everybody for listening, for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe today, and we hope everybody's well, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, guys.
Dave and Jeff would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. As we talk about difficult issues facing our profession and chat with colleagues who have strong opinions of those issues, we feel it is important to note that the opinions and views expressed by Dave, Jeff, or our guests on the Vet Tech Cafe podcast are solely theirs and theirs alone, and do not represent any other person, business, institution, or any other entity. If you have any questions relating to this, please email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. Thanks again for stopping by the Vet Tech Cafe.